Good morning, and thank you very much for coming to week four of four. The last class in this series, as I mentioned last week, it looks like we will have a series on business ethics topics. Haven't yet figured out which ones we'll do. We'll find out. Running from October 14th until it looks like the end of November. As our first mini-series of the year, that'll be at Beth Emeth. And Loretta, I expect, will be sending out details. I'll send out details once we actually, you know, have details to send out. There should be more source sheets at the end of the table there or there. Someone? Okay, there's a pile there, so if anybody needs. Our topic for this morning is the value or the ethic of community. You know, we've talked about life. We said that the patient is obligated to seek life, even though God is, you know, considered the healer, capital H. Nonetheless, that doesn't stop us from being healers, lowercase h. The doctor is obligated to preserve life, whether under the mitzvah of the obligation of not standing by while someone's blood is shed, or the idea of restoring someone's lost property to themselves and their health counts as far as that. So we said that there's an obligation of preserving life, and that was our first medical ethic, if you will, that drives the way we approach taking care of patients. But then we set up the second week with a little bit of an opposition, and that is the value of avoiding pain. We said that even though there is an idea within Jewish tradition that sometimes God may send somebody pain, that does not mean that the person is supposed to grin and bear it. And we're certainly not supposed to go looking for it. Pain is something that if we have to deal with it, we deal with it, but we would rather mitigate it and avoid it. And part of the obligation of practicing medicine is actually to try to mitigate people's pain. And so that brings us potentially into an opposition between extending life and mitigating pain, because sometimes extending life means extending pain. And then we discussed what one is supposed to do and talked about the issue of potentially opting not to receive treatment. And we briefly discussed physician-assisted suicide as well. And then we moved into the third week and we talked about a third ethic, a third value, and that is human dignity. And the Torah recognizing the dignity of the human being as a creation of God with a special image designed for the human being by God and given special status. And we said at the same time as we value human dignity, we also recognize that if you're going to say that dignity is given special status because God has designated it for the person, well, that means that there may be a time when the religion says dignity is to be overridden. There are certain points in which we'll say maybe that there are higher values. And the application we discussed was that of cosmetic surgery, and the question of when we say that the pursuit of greater dignity via surgery, when we say that actually overrides the when will we say that the pursuit of that greater dignity overrides concern of Jewish law for endangering oneself, concern for not wounding oneself, and when we'll say that the other values override that? So that all of that. That's all history at this point. But now we want to look at the value of community. And when I say community, what I mean is the question within medicine of how I deal with large numbers, how I deal with a situation in which I want to take care of the health of the community, but it may come at the expense of an individual, and whose health comes first. So public health is a very broad, very big topic. And it involves issues that are practical as well as issues that are hypothetical, which are fascinating. And we could really spend many weeks on the topic of public health. But take a look at source number one, where we see the challenge of the community versus the individual. This is an article that came out several months ago during the Ebola crisis, but the same article could have been written earlier at the time of SARS, from the CBC. Hospitals across the country, the title is, Can Health Workers Refuse to Treat Ebola Patients? And the answer is, maybe. That's the headline. So now you don't need the article. But hospitals across the country are working hard to make sure they're ready if a patient with Ebola walks through their doors. But some healthcare workers think they should have the right to refuse to treat anyone with the virus. You might be surprised to know that in some cases, they may just have the law and professional ethics on their side. And then it goes on with some of the details, and then it says, a 2010 paper written for members of the Ontario Nurses Association, or ONA, says provincial legislation gives healthcare and other workers a limited right to refuse unsafe work without fear of reprisal, provided there are circumstances where the worker has reason to believe there is danger. For instance, they can refuse to work with any equipment or device that the worker is to operate or use that is likely to endanger himself or herself and others. The worker can't refuse the job. Can't refuse if the job is what they do ordinarily. So a lab technician can't refuse to handle a blood sample from a patient with an infectious disease, but could refuse to handle the sample if the suspected virus is highly infectious and if proper protective clothing and equipment are not provided. Clearly that exception has bearing in cases of Ebola and so on. What do you think? Should doctors, nurses, technicians be able to say, we're going to sit this one out? Yes? No, that's you. Okay, so that's one argument, is to educate and presumably then make people more comfortable. There was a hand here, and then, yeah.
Well, I think it's an interesting issue. What if we had policemen who said, well, this situation is too dangerous, I choose not to engage. Firemen who said, gee, if I run into that fire in the towers, I'm likely to die. There's a possibility I'll die, against everyone's personal choice. About whether or not they wish to take it on.
So are you suggesting, accepting the equation of the doctor with the fireman with the with the police officer, are you suggesting then that by signing up to be a police officer, to signing up to be a firefighter, you are now agreeing that you will in fact go into that building where the odds are terribly against?
Sign up for. Although I don't think that if health safety standards aren't in place, I wouldn't suggest a fireman runs in without his equipment, without his uniform. But I think if all the standards are in place, then that's what you sign up for.
Could be, yes.
Well, I think that even the wording in the paragraph you read leads us to, it's part of how in our province all employees have certain rights and protections, and it basically has to do with things alluded to here. It has to do with knowing how to use dangerous equipment or items, whatever, and knowing what procedures to follow. And it was proven with Ebola, for example, where in the countries where they hadn't trained the workers in certain areas in Africa, for example, where the workers weren't trained at the beginning on how to cover themselves and how to avoid the liquids and all this stuff, that they got it and died. Whereas once the skill set was upgraded and once you have the right equipment, such as the proper protection physically, you can deal with it. So it's a matter, it does get back to the education point, but it's the general issue that employers have an obligation to train people and make sure that they have the equipment they need to do their job.
Agreed, but I wonder, because both of you pointed to the need for sort of the standard of protection, the uniform, the equipment, and the training, and the education piece of it also. But what about where you develop your procedures, but everybody recognizes that they're really insufficient? Meaning, The article distinguishes between doing your normal job, which it defines as doing whatever your job description is with a standard of protection that is considered normal, versus where you feel like the normal protections aren't in place. But what about where you know that the normal protections are inadequate? So for example, when they were dealing with Ebola, there were nurses in hospitals where they had the training, where they had the equipment, but because of the sheer number of times that you have to put things on and take them off and go into the room and leave the room and handle the equipment and so on, human error guarantees. Just you have a certain error rate that has to be expected. And therefore, all of your equipment and training and standards aren't really guaranteeing your safety. So at what point do you say our standards are not high enough, and therefore we can't put people in harm's way, or at least we can't demand of people that they put themselves in harm's way? Ian?
Let me say this. Today there are more challenges of authority in many areas. And even when, for example, when soldiers apparently go to war, many, not many, not members of the earth, said, I'm not going to risk my life by going to battle.
That's not new, though.
No, that's not new. They probably can make a decision not to go into a fire or whatever situation it is, but they are trained very thoroughly not to do that, but they still probably do it.
So I think it's important to realize that, yes, I mean, the idea of not doing it, of backing out, is not a new phenomenon. And I think that realistically there is an understanding that they're not supposed to endanger themselves. Where they know it's a lost cause, they're not supposed to be the hero. You know, so I think that's also significant. I'm going to take Stephen and then make one more observation on this before we jump into the sources themselves. Yeah.
One side of the issue we did look at is what's in the public's interest, the ones who aren't ill, and that is even more important, I think, ultimately, than the actual worker. But if it was smallpox, which is more or less eradicated, what if it's an alien disease that comes down and it isn't known even what it is or how it could be transmitted? The workers, it's not enough. In other words, every worker, if you have 1,000 workers, there might only be 5 that are so qualified and are so astute at what they're doing. So we want the best workers to be able to do it, not to shun others that are willing to do it. It has to be, in certain cases, the cream of the workers, not the average workers that do a fantastic job day to day in the labs that we see all the time. It has to be certain individuals that both are willing to not just take the risk, but that have a superior, the highest level of knowledge.
So you're suggesting that it's in the interest of society to specifically endanger the workers who are best?
Yes, if the workers aren't the most qualified, society's in danger.
No, I think it's an interesting question. I don't think any of this should be taken as straightforward, and I think the question becomes more complicated when you move into the new situation, when you're dealing with a disease that's not known and well understood and for which the protections are not clear. It becomes more complicated, but really what I want to ask here is the question of individual versus community. Where the, I'm sorry, I need to go a little further with it. But the question, not so much of where we think that they'll be safe, and the question is only what's the percentage risk, but where it's actually a matter of somebody saying, as healthcare workers have done for centuries, I'm going to go treat people during an epidemic knowing full well that the odds are against me. But because this is a community, it's the many, therefore my personal needs are outweighed. Is there such a calculation to be made for a person to say, I will sacrifice myself on behalf of the great many people I can save before I succumb to whatever illness it is? That's really, that to me is the core question, and everything else sort of moves from there. So take a look, please, at your sheets. There's a lot we should be saying about this, but I want to move into some of the sources and try to see where we can go with it. Basic principle, the importance of communal survival. And the idea that the community has greater value than the individual. That in fact, as the line goes, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. If you take a look at source number 2, we get a biblical example of it from the book of Esther. If you remember her story, right? She becomes queen through this whole beauty contest replacement of Vashti, and the decree is made to destroy the Jews. Mordecai goes to Esther and says, go to the king and get this decree halted. And Esther says, you know, I haven't been summoned to the king for 30 days. Which has multiple potential explanations. In other words, she may be saying, I haven't called him for 30 days. Let me wait because I'm apt to be called soon. And if you barge in on the king, the odds of survival suddenly drop to nil. So let me wait. He's gonna call me one of these days. Or another explanation is, he hasn't called me in 30 days. Maybe I have no influence with him. It could be I am now on the outs. So therefore, I'm not really going to succeed anyway, so why should I do this? So take a look at source number 2, where Mordechai sends his answer to Esther. And Mordechai said, to respond to Esther, do not imagine that you will flee to the king's house from all of the Jews. For if you are silent at this time, salvation and rescue will stand for the Jews from elsewhere, and you and your father's house will be destroyed. And who knows whether you attained monarchy just for a time like this. Right? Very harsh words of rebuke. He says, look, you think that this is your get out of jail free card. You're going to hide in the palace and all the Jews are going to suffer, but you're going to be safe. Not necessarily going to work that way. He says, this may be why you're there. This is your job. And Esther responds. And Esther said to respond to Mordecai, go gather all of the Jews found in Shushan, fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night and day. I and my servants will fast likewise. Then I will come to the king against the rules. If I am lost, I am lost. And in fact, the way the story plays out, she goes to the king, she invites the king to a party, she then goes to the king at the party, invites him to another party, she knows very well how to work with the Persian monarchy, and in the end, it all works out. But in terms of this story, the message that the reader draws from this little conversation between Mordecai and Esther is the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Yes, you'd be safe if you hid in the palace. Remember, the people in the palace do not know her lineage. They don't know that she's Jewish. She can get away with it. But he says, that's not what we do. We put ourselves on the line on behalf of the community. So that's a key source in this. And it has applications beyond the realm of medicine. It's not only a medicine point. Someone made the point here, I think it was Ian who made the point about war. And the fact that in war, this is done as well. The sages were bothered by the dispensation in Judaism for fighting a war. We are told, we spent week 1 on it, that we value life. That one is not supposed to endanger one's life. Just the opposite. We are obligated to protect our lives. So, with that as our framework, what's the justification for going to war? Leave aside all the other ethical and moral problems that are involved in war and its motivations. That's not the point. The point right now is, how is the soldier who has a basic mitzvah of guard your life well, justified in going out to war? We know there are going to be casualties. And yet, the Torah very clearly outlines procedures for war conduct in a military camp, right? This past year, in October, November, we had a 5 or 6 week miniseries on issues of war and the ethics of going to war. How in the world are you going to war? You're endangering yourself, aside from the greater issues that come up. So take a look at source number 3. Rabbi Yosef Babad, author of the work Minchat Chinuch. If you've heard me quote the book Sefer HaChinuch before, Sefer HaChinuch is the anonymously written work from the 13th century, roughly, 13th or 14th century, which describes all of the mitzvot, all of the commandments of the Torah, and gives a little blurb about each of them, explaining some of the lessons of the mitzvah, some of the laws of the mitzvah. Minchat Chinuch is a relatively late commentary written on it, trying to expand on some of the legal issues that come up. So he's writing regarding the 425th mitzvah in the book, in Sefer HaChinuch, and he says, regarding the justification for going to war, he says, it is known that the Torah will not depend upon miracles. That's a basic principle in Judaism, that we are told not to rely on a miracle to save us from trouble, as explained by Ramban, Nachmanides, and it is normal for people to be killed on both sides in a war. And so we see that the Torah decrees to do battle despite the danger. If so, then the concern for danger is overridden in this case. The concern for the danger to the life of the individual soldier is overridden in this case. What is it that is overriding the danger? The need of the community. Because we are under attack, and therefore we need to defend ourselves, and so we need to go to war. That's the idea, that there is something more important than the life of the individual, and that is life of the nation. And even though, from a philosophical standpoint, you could argue and say, well, the nation is just a group of individuals, and therefore it's individual versus individual, the answer is it's not. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So far, so good? Clear? Okay. Another source on this that unfortunately has been all too practical for Jews over time is source number 4. Some of you may have seen this. I've used it in various talks. A passage from the Talmud in the volume called Gittin. How many people here are familiar with the term Tikkun Olam? Right, it's a popular term. What does it mean? Repair of the world. Give me an example of repairing the world. Environmentalism is often cited as repair of the world. Tzedakah, philanthropy, is viewed as also, you know, generally speaking, we think of Tikkun Olam in very nice, positive, happy ways. This one is not so happy. This is part of a series of laws that are presented that are a function of Tikkun HaOlam, repairing the world. One may not redeem captives for more than their market value for the sake of Tikkun HaOlam. What it's talking about was a widespread phenomenon in Roman times, in which the Jewish community, being a vulnerable community, not being protected by the various provisions of Roman law, were vulnerable to kidnappers. And what the kidnappers would do is they would attack a community, or they would attack people traveling on the road. They would grab captives, and then they would take them to the next town, and they would sell them into slavery. It was a money-making proposition for them, because the Jewish community was a very vulnerable community, so you would kidnap people and you would sell them. So the Jewish community has to come up with a response to this. Now, the kidnappers say, well, you can buy them off us just as easily as anybody else. Ransom them. So the Jewish community is now faced with a problem. You have people who have been taken captive. They could, in the context of being sold as slaves, they could end up who knows where, under who knows what conditions. They'll be separated from the Jewish community, so let's ransom them. What's the problem with ransoming them? They'll do it again. Right? Well, there are really two issues. Problem number one is that it costs a lot of money. Problem number two is, even if you raise the funds, that just encourages the kidnappers. This becomes an even better proposition for them. Because now, they don't even need to worry about all the marketing. Right? They don't need the ad campaign. Here, we have slaves for you. All they have to do is take people captive, threaten to sell them as slaves in the next town, and the Jewish community is going to hand over the money. So the sages look at that and say, we need to institute a rule for the sake of Tikkun HaOlam, repairing the world, in this case, frankly, saving them from disaster, where they're just being kidnapped and then they're spending their assets on redeeming them and kidnapped again and ransoming them again. And it says, you're only allowed to redeem them for their market value. whatever the sum is that they would get, you can't make this too, what's the word I'm looking for? Lucrative, thank you. You can't make this too lucrative for the kidnappers. If all they can get from you is what they would get on the slave market, then hopefully you manage to keep things down. They don't ban ransoming altogether. They don't play the game of we do not negotiate with terrorists. Because realistically, you can't. People are going to want to ransom. They're going to have a need to ransom them. But they put a cap on what you can spend. So market value is the slave market value, whatever the captors would have gotten for them and you know, where they were going to sell them.
Because market value can vary.
Yes, market value is absolutely going to vary. Well, not so subjective, because remember that in Roman society, prices for goods, and the slave was a good, unfortunately, but the prices for goods were generally fixed. The systems that the Romans worked with in those days were, in general, fixed markets. That's how they managed their economy.
So where's the justification? One for a thousand?
It's a good question. So Stephen asks the question, which has come up, unfortunately, quite a bit in Jewish history. We think of it as being new, so to speak, since the 1950s or so when the current wave came up, but this has been an issue all through Jewish history. The question of prisoner exchanges and ransoms. The Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg was held captive in Germany in the 14th century, and he actually instructed the community not to ransom him, and they wanted to pay more because they said, "Well, he's our leader," and he refused. And not only that, he ordered them that they not ransom his body. He said he will die in jail, and they should not ransom his body either. They ended up ransoming his body after he died anyway. But this is unfortunately a recurring theme in Jewish history, and particularly in European Jewish history. My point in bringing it is only to say that they're trying to balance, again, needs of the community versus needs of the individual. And the statement that they're making is, you can't break the back of the community for the sake of the individual who is being held captive. Once again, placing community above individual. And now let's get to a medical application. The issue of quarantine. It was a big issue during the Ebola crisis, particularly in the U.S., right? There was a nurse who had come back from treating people and she had no signs of anything and they wanted to confine her anyway. They came up with some compromise in the end, just to check in every day or whatever the compromise was. So the issue of quarantine is not a new issue within Jewish ethical discussion. In general, we avoid quarantine. That's we don't believe in, from a Jewish ethical perspective, confining somebody's movements. If you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, a major rabbinic authority in Israel in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, wrote as part of an article called in Hebrew, Onesh HaMaasar BaHalacha, the punishment of imprisonment in Jewish law. So he wrote, God, who, quote, shows the way for penitence, that's a verse, after they descend into the world of sin, did not choose to punish them with imprisonment. He is good and just. Although imprisonment seems righteous and just, it certainly is not good, not in itself, because it involves removing human liberty, and it's also not good in its results. And he goes on to discuss various studies that have been done about prisons and the results of imprisonment in terms of rehabilitation and deterrence and so on. He is a believer in not imprisoning, if at all possible. Granted, he recognizes that there is a need sometimes to imprison certain people for the protection of society. The point is not to say there's no such thing as imprisonment, but rather to say that the value within Judaism is to try to reduce it, to minimize the use of jails. We do have one case biblically of a mitzvah that involves imprisoning somebody. What's that case? I don't mean that, I mean like a law, right? The case of Joseph is not one to be emulated. Yes. So the Ir Miklat, very good, the city of refuge. There's a biblical law that says that the Jews are told to set up 6 cities when they enter into Israel, 3 on the eastern side of the Jordan, 3 on the western side of the Jordan, which will be cities of refuge. Normally those cities are inhabited by Levites, The Levites don't have a tribal portion the way that other tribes do. They're dedicated to service in the temple. But along with the Levites living in these cities will be anybody who commits murder by accident. If someone kills somebody else accidentally, they flee there. The courts hear the case to ensure that this in fact was not intentional. And that person remains there to be protected from the relatives of the person who he had killed. But there, it is generally understood that the goal is protection of the murderer, not protection of society against him. This is somebody who did it by accident. It's viewed as being something that's for his own protection, and if he wants, he can leave. There's no law requiring that he remain there. He just has to know that he's accepting upon himself whatever happens. You didn't have, in Jewish history, the concept of debtor's prison, which existed in various secular societies, where a person was in debt and wasn't able to pay back. So they said, well, let's put him in jail, because that, of course, will enable him to pay back. I'm just thinking Greece right now. But the idea of imprisoning somebody who was in debt didn't exist within Judaism. We generally did not go for imprisonment. We don't like the idea of restricting somebody's movement. Yes? So slavery existed, but not as a function of debt. The slave system existed either if a person stole and was not able to pay back what he had stolen, so he would be required to work until he could pay it off, or if a person chose on his own and said, I can't survive, so therefore I'm going to sell myself for a period of time. And the basic system of slavery that was recognized was a system in which whereas normally a worker would be at will. A worker within Jewish law is able to leave at any point and simply say, I'm done, you don't have to pay me anymore, unless by leaving he will hurt that which he has already produced for the person. So he's building him a wall and he leaves and the wall collapses, that he can't do. But otherwise the worker is able to leave. And in this case the slave says, I am willing to give up that right for this period of time in order to be supported by the person for whom I'm going to work. And we can have a longer discussion about the parameters of it and so on, but it was frowned on. It was very clearly frowned upon. It was not considered a good thing for somebody to do. And there are various laws that surround it that really reinforce that. So the question of quarantine then, what about where you have an individual who is viewed as a threat to society because of some illness? Is society able to say, we want to keep you away from the community for the sake of the community? So Rabbi Chaim Palagi dealt with this issue in 19th century, and he discussed the question of a doctor who has been treating people during an epidemic, and whether you can ban this doctor from attending the synagogue. Because there's a population there, he's going to be a vector, he's going to transmit to people around him. So he argued that there is indeed the possibility of quarantining this person in order to protect the community. He discussed various precedents for it, and he says, yes, it could be done. One idea that is floated is the idea of giving him his own section. Right? In other words, you set up a barrier and you say, he has to show up before everybody else, so he'll be in that section, and then let everybody else come into the synagogue, and then once everybody is left, then he can come out from behind wherever he is. But the community is given primacy over the physician. Leave aside the question of whether that's going to work and protect people. You're dealing with 19th century medicine, and its concept of contagion is not exactly up to where we would like it to be. But that's an example in which they say, yes, community trumps individual. He also discusses whether it's an overreaction, and he says it's a medical question, really, that has to be dealt with by physicians. On the other hand, having said the community trumps the individual, we have to recognize that it's not so clear-cut. And the reason that it's not so clear-cut is because there are higher values than survival. Survival is important, but there are higher values than survival. What's the idea of having a higher value than survival? What am I talking about here? Kiddush Hashem is sanctifying God's name, meaning? So possibly, if the community's survival would entail a desecration of God's name, maybe that they have to make a calculation about that. Okay. You were going to say?
Spiritual,
along the lines of what Rochelle was saying, or something else?
Along the lines.
Okay. Yes, Vanessa.
Dignity.
Sorry?
Dignity.
Dignity, right? We talked about last week, Kavod HaBriyot, and dignity as a medical ethic. So maybe that's an issue that has to be considered. What is it going to cost the community in order to survive? So I'm going to float another idea. Stephen, you were going to say?
Not breaking the three things that are bad? Eating human flesh? What are the...
Oh, you're talking about idolatry, adultery, and murder. Adultery and murder. Well, yes, in effect. Right? I'm going to frame it a little bit differently. But the moral standing of the community trumps the physical survival of the community. And take a look at your sheet. It's source number 6, and I'll give you an example of this. A passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. Remember last week we talked about the difference between the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. I'm not going to reopen that right now. But look at this passage. We have learned, it says, source number 6. If groups of people are traveling on the road, and they encounter non-Jewish bandits who say, give us one of yours and we will kill him, and if you don't, then we will kill all of you. Okay, so this is similar to the ransom case, except that the stakes are now life and death. The group of Jews traveling on the road, so it's the many, they're given an ultimatum. The ultimatum is, turn over one, and we'll kill him. And if you don't, we will kill all of you. Not where the attacker said, turn over that one, but turn over one. So the Talmud says, then even if all would be killed, they should not hand over anyone. Don't hand over anyone. Ah, what happened? Didn't you say the needs of the many override the needs of the few? Why don't we turn anybody over? Yeah?
If the one is not specified, the morality of the community would be corrupted by having to make the choice.
Exactly. Right. You're going to put the people in the position of playing God and saying, this one dies, then everybody else gets to live. That's a terrible thing. But then look at the next part of it, brought for the sake of completeness. If the attacker specified a victim, such as Sheva ben Bichri, the story of Sheva ben Bichri is a passage from Tanakh, from the prophets, in which you have somebody who is liable for death, and the attacking army says, turn him over, and we let the city go. Otherwise, we're going to wipe out the city. And in fact, Sheva ben Bichri is turned over. So if they specified somebody, such as the story of Sheva ben Bichri, who is deserving of this punishment regardless, then the group should give him over and not be killed. And then the Talmud continues to have a debate. Is that because you're talking about somebody who is guilty? This fellow Sheva ben Bichri is already guilty. You're turning over somebody who's on death row, so to speak. So is that because it's him or not? What would be, leave aside Sheva ben Bichri and his individual case, and leave aside the case of the person who is liable for death anyway. What would be the justification in saying that where they name their person, then you do turn them over? Why is that? If you just told me we're concerned about the moral fiber of the community and we're concerned that they shouldn't sacrifice one for the sake of the community where they make the selection, so why is it okay if the attackers are the ones who made the selection?
They're not making the decision.
Well, they're still turning them over. Yeah, but they're still turning him over. They can't really claim not to be responsible. It's more fundamental to the story. He's gone anyway. Well, they're protecting in both cases. But the answer is, I think, that it's because he's gone anyway. In other words, what's happening is you have 10 people in a group, right? One of them, turn over one of them, a specific one, or turn over all 10, But that specific one is dead regardless. So it makes no sense to say, let the other nine die. Whereas in the first case, you don't know who it would be. Because the alternative for them is, yes, it's true, if they don't turn over anyone, then all 10 of them die. But if they chose this one instead of that one, then that one would live. So by making the decision, you are condemning somebody to death. That's the difference between the two halves here. But the point that I'm trying to make, and the main reason I brought this, is to say that we do put a value on something beyond the survival of the community, and that is the moral standing of the community. Because you would poison the community if you put them in a position of choosing who is going to die so that they can all survive. Now,
there's a volunteer. There's somebody volunteers.
Right, so that has happened in Jewish history. Regrettably, we have stories like that. There's a classic story told in the Talmud about a community that was under attack by the Romans, because the Romans said that, I think it was a princess who had died, and they claimed that Jews had been the ones to kill her. And there were two brothers who turned themselves over and said, we are the ones, even though they were not, for the sake of the community. So yes, historically that happened. The issue that I want to come back to now is the issue that we started with. Forcing medical personnel to treat without adequate safety guarantees. Where you know that your equipment is not going to protect them. Where you know that for all of the education and for all of the rules that you put in place, nonetheless there will be human error, or simply that we don't know enough to be able to protect our medical personnel. Do we compel them to treat? And I wanted to show you two sources. One, source number 7, comes from Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. I've mentioned him before. He was one of the leading authorities in medical halacha, Jewish law and medicine, for decades. Passed away in the early 21st century. And he writes regarding a discussion that goes the other way. The question is a doctor allowed to treat during a time of epidemic? Since we say that you're supposed to protect your life, just like we asked regarding war in the comment of Minchat Chinuch in source number 3. So Rabbi Waldenberg is dealing with the question of, you're responsible to guard your life. Are you allowed to take care of patients knowing that you're endangering yourself? So he says the following. He makes two points. Number one, he says, as part of his discussion in source number 7, it further appears to me that one could say this regarding a doctor. It is standard that the doctor who knows diseases and ailments provides necessary aid. And without this, there will be great devastation for the ill and the healthy. Therefore, he is acting in a standard way for the normal function of the world. And the risk involved in treating the sick is not considered, quote, introducing oneself into forbidden risk. He is establishing that there is such a thing as normal behavior. And that conducting yourself in the normal way is not considered introducing yourself into great danger. We talked about this a little bit in the first week, when we talked about engaging in activities that endanger life, but for the sake of some payoff. So you go to work at a job that involves a little bit of danger, or you take a plane, you cross the street, whatever it is. So he says, this is the way that society works, and we need it to work this way, because we need doctors to treat patients. So it's basic to society, and on that level, he says, maybe it's an acceptable thing. Further, he says, it further appears in my humble opinion that since the doctor does this to treat the sick for a living, he may introduce himself into possible danger for this. It is like the way the Torah permitted a worker to enter danger for his livelihood. He says, you know, this is his parnasa. This is the way that he makes a living. And so his argument in the end is to say that we can't compel healthcare workers to treat, but that they are justified in entering into danger in order to treat. He quotes the case that I mentioned earlier when we talked about quarantine. Rabbi Chaim Palagi has a whole discussion about whether you can block him from the synagogue or not block him from the synagogue. He never entertains the idea that we tell the doctor, you shouldn't be doing this. That wasn't part of the conversation. So Rabbi Waldenberg's position is that it is praiseworthy to treat people in this situation, although we wouldn't force someone to do so. Similar lines, the discussion about live organ donation, right? Talking about someone who was to donate a kidney. I brought you in source number 8 a classic responsum from Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. This is decades old, and the risk is even less now in terms of donating a kidney than it was then. But take a look at source number 8, where Rabbi Ovadia Yosef discusses forcing kidney donation. And he says, in our case, per expert doctors, the risk of donating one kidney is very low. It appears certain that one may donate, and there is a mitzvah too. And then he quotes an idea from Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, who was an authority in Jewish law who lived in Spain in the 15th century. And he dealt with the issue as well of endangering oneself for the sake of somebody else. And Radbaz, that's the acronym for Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, Radbaz wrote, regarding saving property, one, meaning saving someone else's property, one should not endanger himself at all. But to save another's life, even at potential risk, one is obligated to save him. But, he then goes on, Radbaz also wrote that one who introduces himself into potential danger to save another, even where that person is definitely in danger, is a pious fool. One must say that Radbaz distinguishes between real risk, meaning to the rescuer, and small risk. It depends on the degree of risk for the person involved. And so he says, if the odds are inclined towards successful rescue without danger to the rescuer, then one who does not rescue is in violation of do not stand by while your brother's blood is shed. If it's not going to endanger you, then you have to do it. Once we introduce danger, then it becomes dicier. And it goes with, as the degree of risk goes up, the imperative to do it goes down, and the imperative not to do it will go up. Now, obviously, nothing is simple, right? Because all you can get are statistics from the majority of cases, and people in these situations find that their particular situation requires that they look at their case differently. Maybe this percentage of cases are different because this is unique in this case. You know, the donor is 50 in this case, the donor is 30 in this case, or whatever it is. Each case really has unique aspects. And so this is not simple. It is not straightforward. But the point that I wanted to demonstrate from this is when we ask our question about pitting the community against the individual, number one, we have said, going back to Esther as our model, that the needs of the community do outweigh the needs of the individual. It is considered right and heroic and necessary for us to have individuals put themselves in danger on behalf of the community. And we said that the community trumps, and we applied that regarding quarantine, we applied it regarding war, we applied it regarding ransoming captives. But then on the other hand, we've also said that the community has to ensure that it doesn't endanger its moral standing. And so an example of that would be picking a person and saying that person should die for the sake of others. And applying that to our medical discussion, forcing the healthcare worker to say, you have to treat when we don't have adequate protection for you, is a way of selecting people and saying, so you have to endanger yourself for the sake of the community. That closed the loop on that thought. That's not an entirely honest statement. Why is that not entirely honest? To say the statement that telling healthcare workers you must treat even though the protections are not adequate is endangering the moral standing of the community for the sake of its physical survival. Why is that not quite true? It's not quite true because the healthcare worker became a healthcare worker. To a certain extent, they put themselves in that position. There is, within law, we have the concept of a duty of care, where you have a responsibility to certain people. Parents have a responsibility to their children. Teachers have a responsibility to their students. A doctor who is already treating somebody has responsibility to that patient. The laws change. The rules change when there is an existing relationship. And it may be argued that the healthcare worker went into the field knowing this is part of what you do. So it's, even though I'm presenting it as don't force the healthcare worker because of the moral level of the community, it's not quite true because the healthcare worker wasn't forced to become a healthcare worker. So it's not so simple. Yes? Yeah.
We're required to screen people coming into the hospital.
Yes.
Which in effect would put them at risk, but they didn't choose that.
Right.
But they were forced to do that.
Correct. It's not always so simple because, as you said, not all workers identify as healthcare workers, right? We mentioned, if you go back to the opening source, we didn't only talk about direct healthcare workers, we talked about a lab technician. What about a security guard? I mean, maybe they didn't sign up for the safest of jobs either, but it's true, yeah? The question becomes more complicated, without a doubt. You're like, right, so from a practical perspective, it does not. The question of why and why not and which law is involved is an interesting discussion, but from a practical perspective, with like 5 or 6 minutes to go, the answer is it doesn't make a difference. it's a legitimate question because we have within Jewish law certain obligations that Jews have for all humanity and a subset of that, greater obligations towards one's family. So there is such an idea. It's not a crazy question to ask, but from a practical level, it ends up being the same. Yes? So you're asking now about the person who's actually endangering the community by working? So that's a very big problem, right? The issue of vaccinations is another one where this comes up. The person who says, I don't want the vaccine or I don't want the shot for myself, but now they're going to endanger the people around them, is against this. It's like there's a whole set of cases which deal with the individual who is risking the health of the community and what their obligations are and what the obligations of those around them are. So I am an eye doctor. Right? And somebody comes to me and I can tell they should not be driving. So what is the extent of my obligation? I mean, there are procedures for this within the Ontario health system. But what is the extent of my obligation in terms of notifying authorities that this person should no longer be driving? Do I take away their license and their keys? Do I email somebody who didn't just file a report? You know, this question comes up in a lot of different ways. But absolutely, everything we're saying leads in the direction of saying that the individual certainly does not have the right to endanger others. We're talking about endangering themselves for the sake of others. They don't have the ability to endanger the community for themselves. I'm going to take one more, and then there's one more piece that we have to see on this. Yeah.
Going back to number 6, where it says they encounter relative standards. I mean, what is the significance there when someone asks, you know,
right, no, they're telling a story. In other words, actually, the original line there in the Talmud, in the Jerusalem Talmud, just said non-Jews. Not because the laws would be different if the bandits who were threatening to kill them would be Jewish, but because, as the sages say, the sages speak of that which is the standard case. So that was what happened in those days. You didn't tend to see Jewish bands of highwaymen, kidnapping Jews and selling them as slaves. What you did, unfortunately, see were Romans who did it. It's just...
So it doesn't matter...
Correct. No, it's just telling the story that happened. I'm going to go to the last point. I'm sticking around after, so I'm not running away, and you all have my email address, so don't worry. But the last piece is the triage discussion. So what goes first? The needs of the community or this moral obligation that society has to its healthcare workers? So the answer is that sometimes there's a separate factor, which is that sometimes the needs of the many are the needs of the few. where the many are not going to survive if they don't recognize the needs of the individuals involved. So to apply it to the question that came up during Ebola and has come up other times, if I have a certain amount of medicine, whether vaccine or medicine to treat, either way, I'm actually going to put my healthcare workers first to receive treatment. You'll say, well, why is that fair? There are a lot of people who are suffering out there. Why should the healthcare workers be entitled to better care? But the answer is because that's the contract society makes with them when they endanger themselves. If you take a look at sources 9 and 10, this is a discussion not from healthcare. This is a discussion regarding ransoming soldiers who have been taken captive. And the issue of prisoner exchanges was referenced briefly earlier. And the problems of the ratios when you say you're not supposed to do more than market value. Well, what happens when they're telling you that you have to free 1,000 people in order to send back 3 bodies of soldiers who are already dead? What's the justification on the other side for making those deals? So take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, writing a response on this issue. About 40 to 50 years ago, he's dealing with this after the fact, where the decision was made to pay a ransom. And he says, before the eyes of the determining authority was an additional important point. After all the other points he has made in his article on this, he writes, there was an additional issue, the morale of the soldiers of the IDF. When a soldier knows that should he fall captive, the entire state of Israel would stand behind him to free him, he will risk his life in battle without fear. If he knows that the army is going to defend him, he approaches his duties differently. That's one piece of it. And then a second piece of it, source number 10, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, also a very significant authority in Jewish law in the early days of the state, says, because they, the soldiers, will go to war on a mission of the nation and for its sake, to defend the nation dwelling in Zion, there is an unwritten, understood obligation that the nation will use every means at its disposal within reasonable boundaries so as not to endanger national security to redeem them should they fall captive. There is an unwritten understanding that they're endangering themselves for the community. The community is going to go above and beyond for them. Sometimes you recognize that the needs of the community, the needs of the many, are the needs of the few. You have to take care of the few or you won't have anybody who will be the few. And the same thing is true when you're dealing with the healthcare workers and the question of triage and to whom I give my resources. If people are to be expected to put themselves on the line for the community has to respond on their behalf. Or, as I said, you won't have anyone to do that. Yes?
So I think another interesting question is, I can rationalize and understand the reason for putting healthcare workers in hand out for the rest of the community.
Okay.
Then, when you think about SARS, what happened next was the sick and the vulnerable were the next priority to get the treatment, not the community at large. In other situations, the sick and the vulnerable are actually the last to be supported through medical means because they're so sick and vulnerable and they're going to be close to death anyways. So where does Judaism stand on that?
Right. So if we have another hour, the issue of triage in terms of how I treat when I have a society in which some people are more likely to survive and some people are less likely to survive is a little complicated. But I'll give you a piece from a response from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Right. Feinstein distinguished between the case in which you're already treating somebody. And then the question is, do I turn away from this patient to treat the other? As opposed to the case where they both come to the ER at the same time. And he said, in the case in which I'm already treating somebody, I have what we referenced earlier as the duty of care. I am not allowed to effectively end the life of the person I am treating in order to treat somebody else who has greater odds of success. He said, you can't drop the treatment of the current patient. Whereas, two people show up at the same time. I have not begun with either of them. And preliminary examination shows that one has a much longer or much better chance of long-term survival than the other, he said, then you take the one who has the better chance of long-term survival first. It's much more complicated than that. It's one response in dealing with one, you know, particular case. But that's, yes, the issue is dealt with, because unfortunately it is quite the practical question. One more question, and then I'll let everybody go. Just to, again, to mention, as I said in the beginning, our next series, God willing, will be at Beth Emmet in October, starting after the holidays. We'll be discussing business ethics topics. It'll be a five-week mini-series. If you signed up and your email address is on the sheet, well, if I have your email address, which you know because you've been getting the source sheets from me, then you'll get notification about that. And then also, as I mentioned last week, I thought someone was going to come to announce it, but I'll mention it. Do you know if she's coming? Okay, so
the topic of the first day has been changed.
I know nothing about the topic of the first day.
So
let me explain what it is first, and then you can talk to Rochelle about it, because Rochelle knows. I mentioned it last week as well, that the